Right. Hello, thank you. I think you all came back as well. That's good. That's always a positive sign. Now that you've had 10 minutes of me not wittering at you, can I ask again, before I go any further, are there any outstanding questions, comments or challenges about anything we've said so far? Sorry? I don't have such a thing, I'm afraid.
They do have them here.
Oh, do they?
Yes.
Right, is there a problem hearing me then? No? Okay, I'll carry on anyway. If it... Sorry? Right, okay. Here we go then. There are, this is where we start getting the stuff you can use. There are three basic types of symptom in mental disorder, very broadly. What do you reckon they are?
Depression.
Anxiety. Psychosis. Somebody's been reading that now. Absolutely. When you look at diagnoses in mental health, and mental disorder, there are all sorts of different variations, but they all come down to problems with either anxiety, depression, or psychosis. The only real exception to that would be the category of dementias. And that's because they've got additional issues around memory and orientation. But ultimately, the symptoms that we deal with in, you know, in sort of what we would call the functional mental disorders are anxiety, depression, and psychosis. So that's what we're going to look at today in this next half, if you like, the last half of my time to witter at you, what they are and what we do about them. So there we go, just so we know, anxiety, depression, and psychosis. Personality disorder. You heard of that? Lots of them as well, aren't there? What does it mean? What does personality disorder mean?
It's something that they use the word personality disorder when they don't really know what the problem is.
Unfortunately, in practice, you're right. A lot of people will say personality disorder is shorthand for we don't like you very much. But that's not actually what personality disorder should mean. And if you look at the diagnostic manual, the ICD, which is International Classification of Disorders, if anybody's interested, that will lay out specifically what the criteria are for each personality disorder. Problem is the way that they're used, most people who use the terms don't understand the first thing about it. In fact, a little game I like to play, when people say to me, oh yeah, they've got a personality disorder, I ask them which one. The majority of people that use the term personality disorder will not even understand the question. And I include nurses and psychiatrists in that. It's not just, you know, it's not just people who are outside of my profession that don't know. People inside my profession don't know either. But, bottom line for personality disorders, it's a way to describe someone who is vulnerable in one way or another to anxiety, depression or psychosis. They're all about anxiety, depression and psychosis. So, if you're going to take something away from today that you can use, I'll encourage you to think of this. Whatever the diagnosis, apart from the dementias, whatever the diagnosis, the root will be a problem with anxiety, depression and or psychosis. Look at the problem. Don't worry too much about the label. You're not a diagnostician anyway. You're not employed as a psychiatrist, you don't need to be able to name it. Look at what the problem is and deal with that. Does that make sense? All right, cool. So, let's get into it then. Oh, sorry, and learning disabilities, because I know there are a number of people here who also work, I think probably a lot of people here who work in learning disability services, is that right? Yeah. Understand that, of course, as I'm sure you know, learning disability is not a mental disorder. But what it will do, in many cases, is it will make people more vulnerable to mental disorders simply because the greater your learning disability, depending on the type of learning disability as well, the harder it might be for you to develop and use good coping skills. And that's why there is a link between learning disability and mental disorder, but they're not the same thing, and it's always important to be clear about that. Having a learning disability is not the same as being ill, but you know that anyway, I'm sure. Anxiety. Go on then, what is it? This is where I do my my great art thing. Go on, what's anxiety?
Being fearful of
something. Being fearful of something, okay. I always try to draw the outline of a human body at this point, and it usually ends up looking like Mr. Blobbyfoot. But this is supposed to be a person. Well, actually, he's not going to be that blobby today. But I always do that. I get one big shoulder. Again, I'm okay. Right. What happens in your body? What's the physical symptoms of anxiety? Increased heart rate. Now, because I'm a nursie, I'm dead proud of this. It's the only thing I can actually draw properly. Because I'm a nursie, I can draw, because I had to do it as a student, I can draw a perfect anatomical replica of the human heart. So, who was it that said heart? You're like this. Oh, it's good.
Just like a heart shadow.
This is absolutely perfect in every detail. The valves and superior and inferior, vena cava, not the whole lot, there you go. Perfect representation of the human heart, and your heart rate increases. What else happens?
Sweating.
You sweat. How do I do that? Oh, I'll do that like that. There you go, there beads of sweat. What else? You shake, right? That's a tremor, you want to breathe. What else?
Breathing
holders. Does anybody know specifically what happens with your breathing? Shallow and fast, or rapid and shallow, as I like to say, because that's my stock phrase. So they're supposed to be lungs, and again, it's rapid, shallow breathing. What else?
Cold, clammy.
Sorry?
Cold,
clammy. Yeah, people can get clammy. I suppose that's another part of the sweat stuff, isn't there? Anything else? We're looking just at physical for now. You're right, though, we'll get there. Some people do, yeah, absolutely. When people say that, I'm never sure how to represent it. So I've just got to put lots of little spots on there, and that's itchy. That's itchy skin.
We get a rash as well.
You can do, yeah. Yeah. What else? Oh, now, who was that? Who said that? Yeah, absolutely. You had conversion hysteria. Cracking. I'm going to give you another war story. You probably gathered I'm really into war history. I'm sad like that. Spitfire pilots, Second World War, life expectancy measured in minutes. But their status in this country, to be a fighter pilot, be it Spitfire or another fighter, their social status was immense. But it was terrifying to do that, and to actually be going up and scrambling on sorties three or four times a day sometimes, knowing that you're likely not to come back. There's a big problem there for people, isn't there? There's a dilemma. Do I want to be a Spitfire pilot and die, or do I want to give up the status and live? The only way that you could not be a Spitfire pilot and still keep your status was to be pensioned out of the RAF on medical grounds. Loads and loads of Spitfire pilots developed a very strange paralysis from the hips down. They couldn't move, they couldn't walk, so they couldn't fly. Nobody could find any physiological, anatomical reason for it, but it was absolutely genuine. They get pensioned out of the RAF, and then over a period of weeks or months to get their movement back, and they're fine. And they've got all of the status of being a Spitfire pilot without having to fly and get killed. Nice solution, isn't it? Then Douglas Bader lost his legs and flew again. And suddenly it stopped. And it wasn't because people were trying it on to start with, it's because it was no longer seen as a viable excuse, so that, if you like, their unconscious mind, or however you want to describe it, didn't invent it. So yeah, you can get all sorts of strange bodily things, but most people don't. So rather than worry too much about that, although you're right, it's fascinating field of study that I love, the conversion theory stuff, rather than worry too much about that though, look at the everyday symptoms. Do you get this one? This is me trying to draw a butterfly. You get butterflies in your stomach. You get that churning stomach sensation? Yep. Here's a question for you. Why that weird feeling when you're anxious? What is it about your body that makes that happen?
Is it to do with muscle spasm?
Good try, but no. Well, adrenaline's the thing that makes it all happen, but why does adrenaline make that happen? No, no, it's part of the process of going up rather than down. You were going to say?
Is it just that you're locked in, the body knows it's going to need energy?
Yes! Absolutely. When you get that churning stomach sensation, it's because about 85% of the blood and oxygen that normally goes to your stomach has been diverted to the big muscles in your legs. Because you don't need to digest food when you should be running away. Does that make sense? Here's another question. How many brains have you got? Really, how many brains have you got? You've got one, you've got a brain in two halves, yeah? So we could say two in that sense, but if you go from inside out, how many layers of brain? Three! There are three basic areas of your brain. The bit right in the middle, the top of your neck, that's called the limbic system. I'm going to call that the reptile brain, because even crocodiles have got one of them. I need to ask before I go further, does anyone object if I start talking in terms of evolution? You're all okay with that? Right, okay. At some point in our evolutionary past, we had a limbic system, a reptile brain, and that's pretty much all that we had. And modern reptiles have still just got that, as have birds and a couple of other of the groups of species. That does feed, freeze, flight, fight, reproduce. Basically all it does. That's why crocodiles don't have lots of mates. Because their brain won't do friendship. They haven't got that bit of the brain. That bit of the brain is more mammalian. That's why little pussycats will snuggle together and bunnies hop about and play in the dusk and things like that. It's because they've got that mammal brain as well. They've still got the reptile brain, which does the feed, freeze, flight, fight, reproduce, but on top of that they've got the sociable bit, and so have you. That's why you've got relationships. That's why you do have mates and go down the pub. And when you're down the pub, you talk about stuff, and you can talk about interesting abstract things, and you can solve problems, and you can discuss politics and fallout and all sorts of stuff. Because you've got the primate brain as well. And that's the problem solving part. Now remember what we said about when you're anxious and you need to either run away or fight, and we'll put it into evolutionary terms, you're running away or fighting a saber-toothed tiger. When you're anxious, which bit of the brain do you need to use to escape? The reptile bit, the limbic bit. The bit that crocodiles have got. Do you need to have the bit of your brain working at that time that solves problems? Of course you don't. You just need to be able to leg it. Nor do you particularly need to have that compassionate, friendly, warm, oh hello, nice to see you part of your brain going either. Because that's not relevant when you're either running away or fighting. So just like the blood supply to your stomach gets reduced by about 85%, the same thing happens to the more advanced parts of your brain. The more anxious you are, the more likely you are to think like a crocodile. Does that make sense? Another question for you. At what stage of life, given that you lot are very often involved with children, at what stage of life do human beings think like crocodiles? Babies to about two. Yeah, early stages. In neurology, you might have heard this before, in neurology in peds, one of the things that we see is that you spend the first 5 years of your life growing your brain and the rest of your life trying to learn how to use it. I think that's lovely. 2-year-olds tend to operate primarily with the limbic system. You ever tried to rationalise with a 2-year-old? It's not the easiest thing in the world, is it? When you've got somebody who is anxious, they are thinking like a 2-year-old. It's usually not terribly helpful to try and explain to them why there's nothing to be frightened of. They won't get it. Does that make sense?
Can I just say something?
Please do.
Because a lot of the children that we have suffered early trauma, and looking at attachment theory, there's lots of research being done on the development of the brain,
yeah,
the part of the brain, the ball,
empathic side of the brain developing. And there's actually, they did a study years ago on the Hungarian orphanages, and they actually looked at the brain, and there were parts of the brain that were physically, you could see that were physically developed.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So again, it's sort of, it's very much lived, because a young person who's suffering that amount of anxiety at very early stages of their life is also
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at, we were talking about personality disorder earlier, if you look at some of the scans around what we call the primary personality disorders, like antisocial sociopathy, you find real cortical immaturity for just that reason. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I don't want to get too hung up on that, because that's not stuff we can use, and it's not stuff that you can use in your practice, but I think you're right, certainly. But however people end up prone to anxiety or with those difficulties with attachment, and I know that Colin, you're going to talk about attachment much more later on in one of the workshops. If you are on the ground faced with somebody who's anxious, don't try to explain to them anything complicated. And complicated is probably more than short, simple sentences, because they won't get it, because they can't. Do imagine you're talking to a toddler or a crocodile. And the other thing about crocodiles is the bite. Look at the physiology of anxiety, what we've got there. How does that differ from the physiology of anger? Doesn't, does it? It's identical. Your body's only got one response. It's either aroused or it's not. If it's aroused, you will go to anxiety or anger, depending upon how you interpret the situation. And if I'm in your face when you're anxious, you might see me as a threat. And then you might hit me. So if you've ever had that perplexing situation where somebody's really scared and you try to help and they get angry with you, that's why. It's because you've just gone and baited a crocodile. So what do, that's the question, what do anxious people need from us?
Reassurance.
Okay. We've got reassurance and security. Somebody said support. Clarity and simplicity. They need a good role model. Be calm. Sorry? Time, absolutely. Although sometimes it's going to happen really quickly. But if you've got the time, and you need the time, of course, but I'll say that's a prerequisite for all of our people, really. There's one really, really important thing about anxiety. If I'm really anxious, I am looking for cues. I can't think because I'm looking for danger and I'm looking for safety. Does that make sense? So, give them a little haven of safety. Be that calm port in a storm. And that means looking after things like your breathing, make sure your body language isn't threatening at all. Don't try to reason with an anxious person. At least until they start to come down somewhat. The way that you'll know when someone's come down is if they can problem solve. So what I would suggest that you do is be absolutely calm, be there for them, say nice reassuring things. Don't argue if they say you don't understand, say, well, okay, fair enough, but I'm here for you anyway. Hold them if that's appropriate, it may or may not be, but don't hold them so they're restrained because they'll struggle, and it's probably not appropriate anyway in most settings. And generally, wait until they're calm enough to have this discussion. What's the one thing that all anxiety has in common? It's fortune telling. People are anxious about what they think will happen, and they think it is more than they will cope with, otherwise they don't get anxious. Does that make sense? You're never anxious about the past. You might be upset about it, but you're no longer worried about the past. You're not anxious about it because it's happened. You're only anxious about what you think you won't be able to deal with in the future. So when they're calm, it's very useful to have a discussion with people about fortune telling. I kid you not. Does that make sense? The way I like to do that is I talk to them about what's the worst that can happen. If that did happen, how would you deal with it? So we know we can cope with it. Right, how do we stop it happening? And it's those three stages. What's the worst that can happen? How do you deal with it if it does? Right, how do we stop it happening in the first place? There's more to it than that, of course. But I've only got an hour and 45 minutes, so that's it for the anxiety part, unless there is or there are any questions, comments or challenges about it.
Can I just ask about panic attacks?
Of course you can.
Is the panic attacks just the extreme end of anxiety?
Yeah. It's just when your body gets more and more and more aroused.
But the symptoms become much more extreme.
Yeah, but it's the same symptom. Yeah, just more of it. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, what happens when we become anxious? We know, this is a nice discussion to have as well in terms of the fortune-telling thing. Freud talked about appropriate and inappropriate anxiety. Because appropriate anxiety is great, it keeps you alive. That's the thing that makes you jump out of the way of the car that's coming towards you, for example. You get anxious, you move. Sometimes you move before you realise you're anxious, but nonetheless it's that freeze, flight, fight response that's done it. Sorry?
You know, you need to fire by fighting.
Yeah?
And then you have to be at a normal state, or does it move on
from that? It moves, and we'll talk about that in a moment, but I don't want to preempt it. Alright. Let's say you've done your anxiety stuff, you've been really, really anxious because you think you're about to, I don't know, lose your job. And you're really anxious about the possibility of losing your job, and then you lose your job. You're not anxious about losing your job anymore, but you might be anxious about how easy it will be to get another one. Until eventually you realise you can't get another job in this climate, nobody wants to employ you because you're, I don't know, 52 or 62 or whatever, and there are people who are a lot cheaper and there's no work in our industry anyway at the moment, and you give up. At that point you stop being physiologically aroused, don't you? Yeah? You go the other way. Your body goes into de-arousal. There is nothing to strive for when you give up. What do we call that? It's depression, isn't it? When you get depressed, you're not predicting the future negatively. You are simply concerned that the past has already been more than you could cope with. In broad terms, those distinctions blur around the edges a bit. But essentially, if anxiety is a call to action to try and solve a problem, depression is giving up. So instead of being aroused, you get the opposite. People slow down, their breathing becomes deeper and still quite slow. And often their thoughts slow down, and in really profound depression you can get physically, people get slow, and one person described it to me as trying to walk through treacle, just walking up the street. You actually get to a really profound, there's a thing called moribund, which is where people just don't move at all. And I know certainly when I worked in acute psychiatry, we'd occasionally get people who were just perfectly physically capable, except that the depression meant that they just didn't move, and you know, you'd have to literally go and turn them to make sure they didn't get pressure sores and stuff, because they were so depressed that the body had just closed down. Because depression and anxiety are essentially physical as well as psychological and emotional responses. Does that make sense? Right, so if you're depressed, what do you need from us? I'll give you a clue, it's not reassurance. People always say reassurance about depression. No point. Reassurance is helping somebody to deal with the idea about what might be about to happen. Reassure somebody who's depressed, they'll just think you don't get it. It's already happened in their head.
Need
hope and motivation. Well, medication is certainly useful. And I mean, in another context, if I was talking to a group of nurses, for example, I'd be talking about medication, but that's not something that you're not prescribers. So, although you're right, I'm thinking more about the stuff that you can do. And I would say it's motivation and positive action. Depressed people tend to stop, so get them moving. But one of the most ironic things I ever came across was a newspaper report, maybe about 18 months ago. There's a hospital in London, and the only bit of green they had nearby was a cemetery. So one of the psychologists had a group that used to take depressed people walking around the cemetery. But it worked, because it's not like they don't know there are dead people, they do. They've always known that cemeteries are there, but actually they could get a bit of exercise, get moving, get the body going. It worked brilliantly. One of the papers got hold of it and said, oh, isn't it terrible taking depressed people to a cemetery, and they had to cut the programme. But it was working, because exercising depression, any sort of movement, getting involved in anything is worth it. Does that make sense? So, for depressed people, get them doing stuff. And above all, get them interested. Albert Ellis, the guy who came up with the concept of rational emotive therapy, and he came up with a set of rational and irrational beliefs. One of the irrational beliefs is that happiness is achieved by inactivity. Which is why people look forward to bank holiday weekends, because you've got 3 days with nothing to do. Funnily enough, by the following Tuesday, a lot of those people will find that they are much less happy than they were on the Saturday morning. Because 3 days with nothing to do is inherently depressing. So get them doing stuff. And get them interested. As Ellis puts it, people are happiest when they are involved in something that they define as more important than themselves. And that's really crucial too. Get them involved in something that they can see matters. So it gives them that idea of validation, of being useful, of having a purpose. But ultimately, get them involved in something. That makes sense? Okay, it's whistle stop. I know it's whistle stop because I want to get to the other stuff. But psychosis. You know, I said there's three groups of symptoms, which are anxiety, depression, and psychosis. Well, in psychosis, we've got three other groups within that. What are the three symptoms of psychosis?
Hallucinations,
which is in the form of hallucination.
Depression.
Well, delusions, yeah, so it's your thinking. And the third one, anyone know? Thought disorder. Right, so hallucinations, it's anything that I experience in any of my five senses that other people don't. There's an argument to be had about whether or not Derek Acora is psychotic, or it's just that I can't hear the spirits. But nonetheless, the textbook of hallucination is experiences in any of the five senses that other people don't experience. So it could be hearing voices, seeing visions, feeling stuff. A lot of people, when they're coming off alcohol, for example, will feel creepy, crawly things up and down their bodies and all of that, which is a true hallucination, really. Delusions, the textbook for that is a fixed false belief. So it's something that is very hard to shift. It's not true, but they really believe it. And the third one is thought disorder, which is not what you think, but the way that you think it. This is a bit more difficult. I'm going to slow down slightly. Does anybody remember Les Dawson? Yeah. Do you remember when he used to play the piano? And he used to play all the right notes, not necessarily in the right order. I thought it was brilliant when he did that, because you could tell it actually was all the right notes, not necessarily in the right order. He must have been a brilliant pianist to do it. But it's a little bit like if you've got all of the musical notes that he should play, and you'd put them all, it's like a big leafy salad, and you put them in this salad bowl and mix them all up. And then you get them out all jumbled up, and that's all the right notes, not necessarily in the right order. Does that make sense? You see the image. Right, there's a thought disorder called word salad, precisely because of that image. If I've got 100 words to say in a paragraph of speaking, and I put them in a salad bowl and I mix them all up, and then you get them out in a random order, that's a thought disorder. It's not what I think, it's the way that I think it. Completely unintelligible to anybody else. But to me, it makes perfect sense. Does that make sense to you? Right. They're the three types of the three types of psychotic symptom. So the really tough question to ask in such a short time is this: what does a psychotic person need from us? That's a really tough one, and I'm intentionally being broad, because to answer that question would probably take a couple of years of full-time education to answer that properly. In 5 minutes, we're just going for broad bullet point stuff. But what does a psychotic person need from us?
Perspective.
Perspective? Go on, can you... Be more specific. Right. So the ability to sort out reality from unreality, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a problem with that. Anybody see what the problem is? Well, also, who's to say that we are right? I think everybody benefits from some sort of interaction. And the question, I guess, is what type of interaction? I don't want to dismiss what you said, though, because I think you're absolutely right. There has to be something about distinguishing between the real and the unreal. If I had longer time, what I'd talk to you about is what we call Socratic dialogue, which is the way that we talk with people who have delusional experiences, and we get them, through a series of questions, to decide what may or may not be true. But it's not me telling them. For two reasons. One is because quite genuinely he says I'm right, and I might not be. I remember when I was a student just up the road in Stafford, we had a guy who, we admitted him with paranoid delusional state. He believed the IRA were after him. Turned out they were. We were medicating this guy because he was delusional. The IRA really were after him, we found out. Ended up having to transfer him to another hospital in another part of the country because we found out where he was. So who says I'm right is part of it. But the other part to that is whether I'm right or wrong, it's a bit like give a man a fish he'll eat for a day, teach him how to fish he'll eat for life. I would rather teach someone how to sort that out for themselves, rather than me have to come and tell them, no, you're wrong. It's apart from anything else, it doesn't work. Rudyard Kipling said, a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. If I tell you that there are no aliens in Venus controlling the lights on that stand out there, you won't necessarily believe me. Why should you? It's only my opinion. But if I teach you how to think through the likelihood of the aliens from Venus actually being terribly interested in the lights at Walsall Football Stadium, and if they had that sort of technology, might they not be interested in doing other things that were maybe a little bit more serious, then I've given you something meaningful, because I've taught you how to rationalise through it. It's a really, really interesting experiment. I will tell you about them. We'll move past it. But really interesting experiment done by a guy called Max Birchwood. Anybody heard of Max? Does a lot of work on early intervention, recently diagnosed adolescents. And they did this experiment. They had this big bucket full of black and white balls. And all that the people who came as subjects of these experiments knew is that there were some black balls and some white balls. That's all they knew. There were several hundred balls in this bucket that you couldn't see through. You could only see the top. And Max had a simple question. Take out as many balls as you want until you can tell me whether there are more white balls than black balls. Let's say there are 200 balls in that bucket. How many would you need to take out before you could decide whether or not there were more white than black? You've got 200 balls in this bucket. Okay, we'll call it a narrow bucket. Yeah, we'll call it a narrow bucket then. Yeah, most people would take them all out, because that's the only way to be sure, or at least take enough out to get 101 of one colour, if you've got 200 balls. People diagnosed with psychosis typically took out 8. That tells us something really interesting about delusional belief. It's jumping to conclusions. Does that make sense? There's a problem we all have. It's not just about people diagnosed with psychosis. There is this myth that people have in our society, and it's this. If I think it, it must be true. People jump to conclusions all the time. One of the most interesting things that you can do for people who have delusional states, or any form of psychosis, really, is teach them that one principle, that the thing you first thought of isn't necessarily correct. Look for other options as well, and then decide which is most likely. And that's the basis of that sort of stuff. I think it's a perspective, was the term you used, but that reality